Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear my co-host, Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick make an attempt to organize this crew that meets most Sunday evening to trade information about their favorite subject, ham radio. Some interesting things have happened this week. If you get the New York Times and you get a chance to look at the Sunday issue last Sunday, which was what? April 17th. Beautiful article entitled, Do Cell Phones Cause Brain Cancer? Very well done article. Something like about 7 or so pages to it. And I can tell that the author of that article is reasonably objective. You could say he presented both sides of the story. Had I written an article like that, I would start off with a pretty biased opinion as to whether or not cell phones are safe. Another very good article that has appeared this week is in the latest issue of Scientific American magazine. Beautiful article, unfortunately only 2 pages long, on the subject of the new alpha magnetic spectrometer, which is about to be launched on the next space shuttle and installed on the International Space Station. The world's highest power cosmic ray detector and analyzer is about to be launched. I seem to remember there was another article. I guess last week we talked a little bit about the latest issue of QST Magazine and an article in there in technical topics. Let me drop. The main thing Mel and Dick try to do is to make connections between people. We're convinced that there's a lot of brain power in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area. Many of those people are within radio distance, ham radio distance of this particular repeater. Many ham radio operators, particularly the beginning ham radio operators, have or should have a zillion questions. How does all this stuff work? How do I understand all this stuff? You've heard me say many times that, in my opinion, inside of a true ham radio operator, there is a scientist who would like to understand things at the scientific level, at the molecular level, at the subatomic level, whatever. And beyond 10 o'clock or so, we do get into the deeper subjects. Before 10 o'clock, Mel and I make a promise that with our so-called new improved technical net, those who sign in during the first hour, we promise to make a sincere effort to at least give them a brief answer to their question. In other words, no one has to listen for more than an hour to get at least the beginning of an answer. The TechNet itself nowadays almost always runs for at least 4 hours, from 8 o'clock until midnight. Very few people can stay up that late. But there's a way you can get around that problem. If you think there's something that took place on the technical net that's of value to you, you go to the website called amateurradio.tangovictor, and essentially all of the TechNets for the last 6 years are all recorded. You can play them back, load them into your MP3 player, and listen to them while you're driving to work. Some people do that. Mike, the man who runs that TechNet, that website, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has stated that 198,000 people have checked into that website, and a high percentage of them are doing it to download technical net information. So there's a lot of information there. You've heard me talk from time to time about how do you get a perfect impedance match to the dipole or the dipole section of a Yagi antenna. There's a separate article in there by K2RW that tells you how to do that, which a number of antenna manufacturers have said it's about time that somebody put it that way so that a degree of understanding can take place. One's a better compliment I've gotten along those lines. Let me drop. There's also separate sections that'll tell you something about how a Smith chart works, how the decibels work, and so on. Much of the TechNet recorded information is documented as to what subject is being discussed during each, you could say, 10-minute period. So there's lots and lots of information there. Not all of it is guaranteed to be accurate, but at least the hit ratio we think is pretty good. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in if you're just listening. After 28 years of the TechNet, we sort of accept the fact that somebody is listening. 188,000 people signing into a website suggests that somebody is listening. Somebody considers the material worth saving, using, or whatever. So we don't need a long list of names of people who are just listening. We accept that after 28 years. We want to use the time most valuably, and so we therefore request mostly people sign in who do have a question or a comment. This is what a typical sign-in would sound like. Whiskey, Bravo 2, Tango, Charlie, Charlie, Rich, and Yes. I'm having a little fun with Rich on that one. Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Kilo Bravo 1, Victor Delta Bravo, / W2, this is Lewis, and Yes.
Kilo Bravo 1, Victor Delta Bravo, I think if I got that right, / 1. Very fine, Lewis. So Lewis is number 1 on the runway. Anyone else? Yeah, this being...
Hey, good evening all, this is K2, K-E-Y.
And there's Mel himself. Looks like we've got quite a holiday weekend here, and maybe not many people are going to be around tonight. We're going to have to stretch Lewis's material out for a full hour. I'm having some fun with Lewis. One more call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Because they do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letter's name and that word yes right now. K2RIW listening.
VPM calling yes to the comment.
Okay, we didn't get the beginning. I heard VPM. Sound like Victor, Papa, Mike. Please give me your full call and your name, sir.
Kilo Charlie 2, Zulu, Papa, Mike, Colin, yes with a question.
Very fine, Colin. We got you that time. Lewis and Colin so far. One last call. Anyone else with a check-in for the TechNet because you've got a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Quick question, Dick.
Okay. Looks like John's going to have one also. KC2WGB. And are you saying you have a point of order you think we should take first, John? Or do you want me to put you on the list? You got it, John.
No, Dick, I was just going to suggest, I know we were very interested in that article in the Times, if maybe you could give us a quick synopsis, if there's time, looks like it's going to be a light night, that would be something great. Just a note. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, we got that, and we got Wesley's list of questions, we got more than enough to go through tonight. Okay, Lewis, we got lots of time, take your time and give us your question. Kilo Bravo 1, Victor Delta Bravo, / 1, K2RIW. Go ahead, Lewis.
KB1 VDB, / W2 actually, I'm still here in Brooklyn, heading to W1 in about 2 weeks. So I had a very basic newborn to ham sort of question for you. Today at a flea market I picked up a meg ohm meter in a very antique looking wooden box. And I guess my question, it's made by Danco, Herman H. Stitch & Co. Company, which apparently is very close by here in Brooklyn. So my question for you is, how would I test this meter to see if it still functions? It has a sort of a built-in generator. So let me put it over to you if you have any questions on it for me. Thanks.
Yeah, way back in the dark ages, Lewis, I did use a megohmer one time. And your next question, your real question is, how do you use it, what is it intended for, why is it built that way, and so on. Many of us know what an ohm meter is. I mean, if I've got a bunch of resistors on the table, Allen Bradley type carbon composition resistors, and some film ohm resistors, and some surface mount resistors, and if I'm being double darn sure when I build my circuit, I put the ohm meter across each one of those resistors before I install it on the circuit, just to be sure that something terrible hasn't happened. Once per a million times, a resistor will be mismarked. I've seen that happen about twice in my life. Lots and lots of resistors that are in circuits that are hot and old, like the cathode bypass networks of oscilloscopes, where there's something like a 50 ohm or 150 ohm resistor, and it's under fairly heavy current throughout its life of the operation of a 012 Heathkit oscilloscope, for instance. That resistor almost always goes to some other crazy value. It may, I'm not sure what the value was, but maybe it was 150 ohms to begin with, and you make its measure, you make a measurement of that resistor today, and you'll find out it's a 721 ohms. And it used to be 150, and that's what's marked on the package. And the oscilloscope behaves very crazy because of that. So putting an ohm meter across the resistor, and by the way, when you do that, quite often you have to remove the resistor from the circuit itself. Other things in the circuit might affect the measurement you make. So if you lift the lead on one side, unsolder it, cut it, whatever, temporarily, and you've got just one particular lead connected to the circuit and the other lead free, and you put your ohm meter across those two ends of the resistor, your ohm meter, depending on what scale it's on, let me drop. It puts a standard amount of current through your resistor, and it measures the voltage drop. But it displays it, it does the calculation, you could say, and it displays the answer in ohms. So a 10-ohm resistor with 1 ampere flowing through it would have 10 volts of drop. Or with 100 milliamps, it'll have 1 volt of drop, and so on. It's a proportional thing, Ohm's law. So to confirm a resistor with an ohm meter makes sense. Now you come along and you build yourself a self-wound, you're winding your own power transformer, a filament transformer, a B-plus transformer, power supply transformer. You wind your own transformer, and in order to be sure that nothing terrible has happened, you'd like to confirm that not one of those turns on the primary has cut through and made contact to the magnetic core of the transformer. You want to make sure that none of the turns of the primary are making any contact to the secondary. Any of these undesired contacts within a transformer are undesirable. So by putting your ohm meter between the transformer winding and the core of the transformer, or between the primary winding and the secondary winding, a typical volt-ohm milliammeter or digital voltmeter can measure probably as high as 10 megohms, but they're only doing that with an internal power supply of about 1.5 volts or something like that. And there's a bit of a problem. Let me drop. I might have a very sharp point of metallic material somewhere in one of those one of those windings, which has only a thousandth of an inch of gap between that sharp point of stripped wire where the form bar insulation has been flaked away, and it's coming very close to the secondary winding or coming very close to the core. With an ordinary volt-ohm milliammeter, an ordinary digital voltmeter, you'll measure the ohms, it'll go to full scale, 10 megohms or greater, and you think everything's hunky-dory. But you'd like a little bit more assurance. A megohmer not only can measure higher number of ohms, but it does it at a higher voltage. Many a megohmer actually expresses something like 500 volts across the circuit being measured. Now when you've got that sharp point of metal that's about to touch a thousandth of an inch away, something else that it shouldn't be touching, and you put it on a megohmer, and 500 volts is expressed across your circuit, you will get an arc from that sharp point. Your megohmer will show the fact that excess current is flowing, and you know that the beginning of a breakdown process is taking place. You know that there is a fault, there is a impending fault in that particular transformer in my example. Or if I just put connectors on the end of a coaxial cable, and I want to make sure that one of the whiskers of the copper braid that's in the outer conductor of the coax isn't coming real close to the center conductor and about to make a short circuit. Again, a megohmer would be a very good way of making that measurement. I'd be putting 500 volts in my example of my particular brand of megohmer across that center conductor to outer conductor after I install the connector. And if a whisker is there ready to arc over, it might do that. If the cable's in very good shape and there's no water in there, I might measure 100 megohms or 1,000 megohms of resistance between center conductor and shield, and I'm...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because I'm getting a very high number of indicated ohms, and the megohmer that I'm using is using 500 volts, and there's probably megohmers that'll put even higher voltage across it, depending on the kind of test you're doing. So I'm now getting a very good integrity test of my coaxial cable with the connectors I've just installed, or the transformer and the windings I've just put on there. You can see that measuring very high number of ohms is at times extremely handy. I'm trying to remember, oh yes, I think I did a calculation once on, in the case of a flash memory device, where you've got the so-called floating gate inside the flash memory, which is really storing the bit of information. And it can store that information for like 10 years. There's a certain number of electrons that during the programming process has been put onto that particular bit of the flash memory. And 10 years later, you'd like to have that number of electrons still present on that floating gate. And you calculate how many ohms we're talking about of leakage resistance inside of that particular element of a flash memory, how many ohms of leakage resistance is required to do that. And you come up with 10 to the 12 ohms and 10 to the 15 ohms. You don't even know how to pronounce that. That's millions and millions of megohms, if you know what I mean. Or by the same token, when I'm running my my Wimshurst machine, that's the thing that's got these two large disks with a whole bunch of contacts on it, and the two wheels rotate with reference to each other. It builds up a high static voltage, and in my particular machine, it will arc a gap of 3 3/4 inches. That's in the vicinity of 100 or 150,000 volts the thing can generate. And in order for it to work well, it requires something like 10 to the 12 ohms of leakage. In other words, the disks must be very dry. There must be no dust or fingerprints on any of the critical portions of that machine in order for it to do its work.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So a makeover in that application would really indicate that everything's working well, or if it's not, it'll tell me how many ohms I'm getting between what elements and what I should clean up. So it's hard to believe that in certain environments, a single fingerprint has enough voltage conductivity, a number of leakage ohms, that can stop proper operation of a circuit. And so a makeover is capable of measuring that. So it gives you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch there. Quite often in the old days, they used to be built in wooden boxes. In the old days, they used to have a high voltage a battery inside. Nowadays, I think almost all of them have a high voltage power supply, and they run from a line cord. And so that's a fun machine you've got. The way most of them are designed, even though there is a 500 volts being expressed between the two leads, it does it through an extremely high resistance, so that even if you put your fingers between the two leads, the amount of current flowing between your two fingers is so small that it's not necessarily uncomfortable or dangerous, if you know what I mean. So that could be a fun machine to have, Lewis. KB1, Victor Delta Bravo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY, got a comment?
Yeah, let's guarantee Mel has used makeovers in even more situations than I have. And so tell us how you've used them and what you've what your opinion of them is, Mel. K2KNB, K2RIW. Sorry about that, K2KEY. I'll get you right yet, Mel.
Okay, I got an instrument that's similar. Interesting instrument. When you said a wooden case, I said, now it rang a bell. It's called a high pot tester, Dick, over.
Which stands for high potential. And so it's essentially the same machine in my mind. Depending on which brand name you buy, they call it many different things. Megomer, high pot, high voltage tester, insulation tester. They get lots and lots of names. But the principle of operation is pretty much the same. You express what you believe is the right amount of voltage to prove the integrity of the particular circuit, and you measure the current that flows, which is really confirming Ohm's law, and the better made machines can measure the residual current that flows through your circuit in microamps, nanoamps, picoamps, very, very small number of amperes, so extremely small amount of leakage can be detected, and that can give you an advance warning that there is something less than perfect in your circuit that maybe is going to give you trouble downrange, and it's giving you a forewarning of that. That's what this machine is primarily used for, in my opinion. KB1, VDB, K2RIW. Go ahead, Lewis.
CB1 VDB. Thanks, Dick. That's great info. Yeah, I actually just weighed it. It weighs about a little under 17 pounds. It's got a huge magnet, you know, hand crank generator. It says on it, it holds three cranks per second holds about 500 volts for the testing, and there's three sections on the metal plate that it says it can test. The insulation test, which I assume is the sort of braid test, it looks like, a resistance test with generator voltage, and a voltage test. And shows, generator voltage, 500 volts, line voltage, 220, and I believe 440 volts. So, it's a pretty cool machine. I bought it because it looks cool, and I figure for my new ham shack, it'll look cool on the desk. And, you know, of course, it looks in great condition, so I'm interested to see if it how well it functions too now.
And even if it's not in perfect working order right now, step by step, you open up that box and figure out how it works, guarantee you can make it work. And if not, you can bring it to a guy like Andy, KWA2CDL, who can fix that anything. He's the guy who runs the tune-up clinics at each of the LIMOC functions, and that'll be working real soon. I am curious, I think you said you bought it at a flea market. I'm amazed that there was a flea market somewhere today, an ordinary ham radio type. Wonder where you were. Looks to me like you've got a very fun type piece of instrumentation. Hope it didn't cost you a whole lot of money. And you're lucky that you saw it before Wesley saw it, because if Wesley saw a thing like that, he would have bought it first. So where was that when you bought it, Lewis? KB1 VDB, K2RIW?
Yeah, Dick, I picked it up at Brooklyn Flea, BK Flea. It's here in Williamsburg. It just started a couple weeks ago, every Sunday. And it's a bunch of salvage, old equipment, all kinds of boxes and wooden things and all different vendors. It's really, really interesting. And this guy bought it at, an auction recently. And, he didn't really know what it was. He just, he bought it because it looked cool. So I picked it up because it looked cool as well. And, of course, I got it home, and, it looks good enough that it should be working. So hopefully to get it to work. And the company is within a couple miles of where I live in Williamsburg here, which is interesting, and they're still in business. So the company is Sandco. It looks like they do all kinds of electronic test equipment and things like that. So I might shoot them an email and maybe have them take a look at it or test it or see if they're interested in checking it out.
When it comes to them checking it out, I don't think you have to do that. Since Sandco still exists, you'd like to have a owner's manual or service manual for it, the schematic diagram. Those pieces of information would give you a lot of useful information. It's nice to have. And so even though it's an older piece, I'll bet you Sandco still has it, and there's a way you can get a Xerox of that. And then when it comes to maintaining it yourself, I think you can do it. I don't think the factory's got to do that. We amateurs, eventually, once we get by the early trepidation, we don't really have a fear of opening up the cabinet of a piece of equipment that we own. In the old days, people used to think that, gee, there's a warranty involved, and you break the seal, you're going to lose the warranty, and maybe there's a scorpion inside with a year's supply of food. Stop worrying. As long as you obey some safety practices and maybe some electrostatic discharge practices to make sure you don't create any damage by walking across the wool rug on a dry day and building up a high voltage on your body and pointing your finger at one of the delicate pieces of integrated circuit inside. As long as you don't do things like that, with care, opening up cases, finding out how they work, fixing them, repairing them, troubleshooting them. We amateurs do that all the time. The people who sign into the TechNet do that. And even if you get yourself into a little bit of trouble, replacing the component that needs replacement is not a big deal. Almost everything is fixable if you've got the right attitude, as I see it, Lou. So don't be afraid. Have some fun with that. Come back next week and tell us what you find as you start turning the crank, measuring the voltage with your voltmeter. So you can take those two leads that are supposed to be producing 500 volts of output. You can confirm that with with whatever voltmeter you've got in the house, digital voltmeter or volt-ohm milliammeter. And if you do use, let me drop. If you do use a digital voltmeter, almost all of the digital voltmeters in the voltmeter scale create a loading within the meter itself of almost exactly 10 million ohms, 10 megohms. So when you're measuring the voltage that's put on those plates when you turn the crank, and you measure that voltage with your digital voltmeter connected, you'll be draining away that voltage very slowly with 10 megohms of stray resistance in your meter. If you're using an old-fashioned triplet or Simpson volt-ohm milliammeter, which has 20,000 ohms per volt, it presents a much bigger load, and it will discharge your megohmer. So that's a normal indication when you see it. And if you have two different kinds of voltmeter, you can actually perform that test and see what's going on. Or don't connect the voltmeter at all. Wait 10 minutes and then measure the voltage and see how much it has leaked down to as a method of measuring the internal leakage of your megohmer itself. High voltage and measurements along these lines can be a lot of fun, and it's very educational. Need any fill on that, Lewis? KB1 VDB, K2RIW.
KB1 VDB. Yeah, that sounds great, Dick. I didn't even think of asking for the documentation on it from the company, the owner's manual and the schematic diagram, and yeah, it was kind of very timely because I was starting to read more about electronics and want to start fooling around with stuff, and just looking inside it, it looks simple enough to be a great little project to see if everything's working at least. And I guess the only part that really potentially could be broken is the analog meters on top, but other than that, it looks like it's pretty cool. So yeah, I definitely appreciate that information. So back to you and back to the net. Thanks.
Yeah, the way that machine is wired, there's a medium amount of protection to that meter, so the chances of the meter being damaged are fairly slim. And within reason, there's even ways of repairing the meter or replacing the meter movement. Most likely, it is a 50 microampere meter movement, and that is a replaceable item with some difficulty. We're now getting into watchmaker work, if you know what I mean. Once you open up the back cage on a Dawson valve movement, a meter type movement, you've got to be super careful that you're in a very clean environment, because the smallest amount of a little speck of steel wool that gets picked up by that magnet and gets into the works can make a very sticky meter. And the meter itself movement is kind of delicate, so you've got to be kind of careful that you're not using a magnetic tool that suddenly gets sucked over, and in the process it whips past the coil and damages the coil because the magnet is so strong and you're using a magnetic screwdriver, you know what I mean? You got to be kind of careful. So go very easy if you have to open up the meter. Don't do that without a bunch of instruction first. But other than that, almost everything else inside, step by step, you can analyze it if it's not doing exactly what you want. And it sounds like a fun machine. As I said, come back next week and tell us what you find. Colin was the next person who signed in. KC2, I think it's, if I can read my writing, Baker Papa Mike. Maybe it's my crazy writing. Over to you, Colin. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, it's KC2ZPM. And my question is about pin diodes and the advantages of using pin diodes for transmittances switching over. That's over to you.
Okay, I missed one word. The advantage of pin diodes over using blank. What was that other word, Colin?
Field effect transistors.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. When it comes to TR switching, transmit-receive switching, many of our rigs have a single antenna connected to the back panel, and when you're in the receiving mode, the signal's coming down that antenna and go through a transmit-receive relay function in the rig, and then the signal goes into the receiver circuits. You key the mic, the relay moves, the transmitter is now connected to the antenna, and the transmitter flows through that switch. So in most cases, in the old days, it usually was a electromechanical relay, single pole, double throw. The center of that relay, the common port went to the antenna. Of the two additional connector ports, the one that's in the de-energized mode usually was the receiver. The one that's in the relay energized mode was the transmitter. The good news about solid-state relays is that when they're clean and working well, they're reliable, they've got milliohms of resistance in the contacting mode, they've got many megohms of isolation in the non-contacting ports, they've got very little insertion loss, they do a very good job. That's the good news. The bad news, relays have a couple of failure mechanisms. Eventually some dirt can build up on the contacts, and the contacts can become vivid, and so you get an unreliable contact. It takes a certain amount of volume for that transmit-receive relay. It requires a certain amount of power going to the coil to throw it, and it takes a certain amount of time to operate. Electromechanical relays, a rough rule of thumb, is they take 20 milliseconds to be actuated. You apply the voltage to it, and the read moves in 20 milliseconds from the receive mode to the transmit mode. And if you're doing full break-in, let me drop. Full break-in type Morse code, for instance, or certain kinds of packet, you would like to have a lot faster than 20 milliseconds of electromechanical time. Really full break-in Morse code by a skilled operator with the right kind of equipment is such that you're sending the Morse code. Each time you lift up the key, in between the dots and dashes, the receiver is activated, and the relay flows that fast, so that while you're sending the Morse code, if the person you're talking to 1,000 miles away missed one of the words or missed one of the sentences, while you're transmitting, he starts sending you a series of dots, 8 dots in a row, meaning there's an error. Or he sends you some other kind of characteristic signal while you're transmitting. And you start hearing, in between your dots and dashes, you start hearing his transmissions, and you know that he wants a repeat of something you just sent. He wants you to repeat the last sentence because he missed it, because there was a QSB fade, or his mother was talking to him, or whatever. That's full break-in. And in order to do that, you're flipping back and forth between the transmit and receive mode thousands of times per minute during the sending of those dots and dashes. I can really wear out a relay in a hurry, and the 20 milliseconds of delay time in each one of those functions might not be tolerable. So now, for reasons of size and speed and reliability, solid-state relays are now becoming very popular. The two main methods of getting solid-state relays are PIN diodes and FET transistors. And even non-FET transistors, but FET transistors. In the case of a PIN diode at first looks like an ordinary diode. Let me drop. An ordinary diode has got, in many cases, silicon material, and the two pieces of silicon material in direct contact with each other. One of those pieces of silicon material have been doped with negative extra ions, and the other half have been doped with positive kinds of exciter ions. So you put some other contaminating materials into these two particular pieces of silicon, and the net result when they're brought in direct contact with each other is that you put a negative polarity voltage on the N material and a positive polarity voltage on the P material. You're forward biasing the diode, and current flows. And you put reverse polarity voltage and no current flows on an ideal diode. That's the good news. In the case of silicon diodes, it takes 7/10 of a volt of forward biased voltage before current really flows. And once current does flow, yes, the diode is now in the conducting mode, but it's only in the conducting mode for the amount of current you put into it. If I forward bias an ordinary diode with 50 milliamperes of current, and if the strength of the signal coming out of my transmitter happens to express a voltage across that diode that's conducting the signal over to the antenna, and the magnitude of my signal is greater than 50 milliamperes, the diode is going to start going out of conduction, it's going to start rectifying, and start distorting the signal. Somebody came up with the idea of building a PIN diode, not a PN diode, the first one I just described, but by putting a layer of material in between the N material and the P material, they call it intrinsic material, PIN, now the diode becomes extremely slow in its rectifying operation. Now, if I put a signal in there of, let me pick a number, 100 megacycles, because...
Repeater, timeout, Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because this PIN method of manufacture has made the diode very slow in its operation, I can now put 50 milliamperes of biasing current on the diode to make it go into the conducting mode, and yet my signal could instantaneously be an ampere, and the diode will not know about that. It'll still stay in the conducting mode because each half cycle of my sine wave of radio signal, my 100 megacycles in my example, is only there for 10 nanoseconds, and as such, the diode doesn't get a chance to sweep away those extra carriers that have been put into the intrinsic region. The diode is a slow one, and therefore, it acts like it's fully on during that time. So the nice thing about a PIN diode is that choose one appropriate for the frequency range you're working at, and they're so slow that a small amount of bias will allow you to control a large amount of RF current. That's the good news. PIN diodes have got some insertion loss. A PIN diode transmit-receive network might have something in the vicinity of one or so decibels, half a decibel of insertion loss. So on the transmitter, it's a slightly lossy network, even though it's nice and compact, and it can have a lot of reliability and can act fast enough for you to do full break-in type operation. FET transistors, and by the way, the PIN diode, if you look at the data sheet of most PIN diodes, they tell you how much equivalent resistance exists across that junction depending on how many milliamperes of forward current you put onto it. A good PIN diode with enough forward current might act like a 4-ohm resistor when it's forward biased, and it acts like a 40 megaohm resistor when it's back biased. But it only goes down to numbers like 4 ohms or so. I'm not sure the exact number, but it's some significant number of ohms, and therefore that is the mechanism by which the PIN diode has some insertion loss on the transmitter or the receiver function. Let me drop. The good news about FET transistors is that you choose the right transistor and you put the right voltage on its gate to forward bias it. A good FET transistor can go down to small fractions of 1 ohm of equivalent resistance between its source and its drain. So as a switching device, a FET transistor is capable of being much, much more efficient. FET transistors used in synchronous detectors, synchronous rectifiers, or in FET-type transmit-receive, single-pole, double-throw relays and whatever, they can do an extremely good job. So if I had my choice between FETs and PINs, it takes a lot less voltage and current to turn on the FET. The FET is much lower in insertion loss, much lower in resistance when it's in the on mode. And so properly chosen, they do a better job. So I would choose FETs over PINs if I had the choice. Now, if your particular transmitter receiver happens to have PINs and you think you want to redesign it and put in FETs instead, go slowly on that. There's a lot more required to properly interface. It's not a form, fit, and function replacement. You don't just unplug the PINs and plug in FETs. It takes rather different operating voltages and whatever to make the circuit work correctly. Maybe that helps a little bit, Colin. KC2ZPM, K2RIW Mazeknet.
KC2ZPM. I was, I'm building a transceiver for 20 meters, and I wanted to use FETs for the switching, and I was wondering why PIN diodes would ever be used for the transmit-receive switching, and if they had any advantages over.
I can say something about those design sticks.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, let me put this pretty simply with PIN diodes. They are very effective switches for RF signals, and they are used in what we call TR switches in transceivers. The advantage of a PIN diode, basically, very simply put, is they have longer than normal, what they're known as carrier lifetime, so resulting in a slow switching process that causes them to act like resistors than actually a diode, especially at the higher frequencies. Go ahead, Dick.
Exactly right. But now I'm putting myself in Colin's shoes, and the word slow is a very relative word. Mel is absolutely right. The PIN diode is a much slower diode if you're using it as a rectifier. But if you're using it as a switch, it's fast. A good PIN diode will go between the receive mode and the transmit mode in approximately a microsecond, maybe even in a tenth of a microsecond. By comparison to other electromechanical switching devices, like the 20 milliseconds required to throw a electromechanical relay, it is fast. But the microsecond of switching time, in other words, if you're using a PIN diode as a rectifier, and it takes a microsecond for it to go from the conduction mode to the non-conduction mode, and you're putting a 1 megacycle signal in there, where the 1 megacycle signal has a positive half cycle and a negative half cycle. The positive half cycle of a 1 megacycle sine wave, it's there for half a microsecond. And the negative half is there for half a microsecond. So the fact that the particular PIN diode I'm talking about goes from the conduction mode to the non-conduction mode in a microsecond, that's fast as all hell compared to your and my normal human experience, but to an RF wave, it is slow. So the word slow is relative. Very slow compared to good rectifying diodes, very fast compared to electromechanical relays. I wonder if I've said it correctly, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Very definite. The PIN diodes, as you said, have a so-called slow response type diode, especially they're capable of really microwave signals. So when they're forward biased, that's one of the, really, that was really the reason they came into general use, was in microwave. Because of, I could say that layer, they call it the intrinsic layer of undoped semiconductor, and of the, I believe they are of, let's see, between very high doped P-type and N-type material, I believe they call P-positive type and N-positive type, to really indicate, you know, the level of doping. I believe the little indicator next to the P junction in the type of device indicates whether it's a the intrinsic material is of the type that is the level, in other words, the level of the doping. Am I correct, Dick? I'm trying to get it in right words, over.
Yeah, I think I agree. When you're manufacturing these diodes at the in the factory where you're doing the what's called a vacuum deposition, you're choosing a gas that has just the right old gallium arsenide or whatever. You've got some kind of exotic material as a gas which is being deposited onto the surface or even into the volume of the material to make it N-type material, P-type material, or I-type material, intrinsic material. So there's a whole elaborate manufacturing process by which you make these three kinds of materials inside of the PIN diode. And the two leads coming out connect directly to the P material and to the N material. They don't connect to the I material. It's a thin layer between the two. When you're looking at a data sheet for a PIN diode, one of the things that you'll have to look for is what's the maximum current it can tolerate, how many ohms resistance does it go down to when it's forward biased, how many milliamps of forward bias does it require to get it into the conduction mode. But the next thing you have to worry about is what is the frequency, the recommended frequency range of operation. PIN diodes, you could say, are a kind of high-pass filter. You choose the right kind of a PIN diode, and maybe it'll give you proper operation from 50 megacycles and up. PIN diodes have a minimum frequency you should not go below. You can go there, but you're going to suffer. If I choose a PIN diode that's made for greater than 50 megacycles, and I decide to use it at 7 megacycles, I've now chosen a diode that doesn't have a long enough carrier lifetime, and so at 7 megacycles, it's not a pure PIN diode anymore. It's going to start rectifying my signal, and it's going to start creating some some distortion if I'm using it to transmit a single sideband signal. So,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So know that a PIN diode has a minimum frequency it should be used at and higher, whereas field effect transistors don't have that effect. You choose the right field effect transistor as a switching device, it'll run for almost any frequency you care about as long as you don't exceed its maximum current and maximum voltage for that particular operation. Your particular field effect switching device maybe is made for up to 10 watts of operation, so to speak, and maybe up to 100 volts of standoff. In other words, the signal going in there shouldn't be greater than 100 volts, and the power shouldn't be greater than 10 watts. Might be a typical specification for a field effect single pole double throw switch, and you can use it at essentially any frequency you want. So it gives you a little bit more of an understanding of how they work and what to look out for when you're replacing them. Occasionally a lightning bolt comes along and damages the field effect transistors or the PIN diode switches of the front end of a transceiver, a radio, and replacing them, as long as you got the right parts in hand, is not a big deal. A skilled guy with a good soldering iron and a magnifying glass, so to speak, can do the replacement of a blown-out part in some number of minutes. KC2, ZPM, K2RIW, you got it, Colin.
Then get back to me, Dick. I got one more interesting observance.
Give us your observance right now. Go ahead, Mel. I've
been seeing in some of the equipment, not at the RF switching point, but at other parts of it, is that they seem to be leaning into using a newer, more, I guess, up-to-date device called a hot carrier diode, Dick. I wonder, you know, I've never really looked into it, but I guess it's based on the Schottky type barrier type of design, and I was wondering, have you seen hot carrier diodes being used extensively in some equipment now, over?
In the past, I have. An ordinary silicon diode used for power rectification, for instance, takes greater than 7/10 of a volt of positive bias. In other words, I need more than plus 7/10 of a volt on the P material when I'm grounding the N material in order for the diode to start conducting. You draw a voltage current curve, and the curve will show very little action until more than 7/10 of a volt is applied to a silicon diode. A germanium diode, like a 1N34, an old-fashioned, still very popular germanium diode, only requires something like 0.22 volts to start doing conducting. Within the world of silicon diodes, if you use this fancy Schottky doping profile, it is possible to make a silicon diode, high-temperature diode, Schottky-type diode, where something like 2/10 of a volt, and some of them are made for very high power operation, only 2/10 of a volt is required for the diode to start conducting. So that Schottky diodes, at least the little bitty ones, the Hewlett-Packard 2301 is a popular model number used 20 or so years ago, using those into a bridge network to make a doubly balanced mixer, to make switching networks, to make limiting networks at low levels, they did a beautiful job. Those small Schottky diodes, let me drop, in those days were not appropriate for high power, but for low power circuits, the audio circuits, the mixing circuits and whatever, they did a beautiful job. If you take apart many of the solid-state doubly balanced mixers you can buy these days, I would guess that a high percentage of them are made out of a quad arrangement of Schottky diodes, these fancy diodes that run at extremely high frequencies. Some of these Schottky diodes are very good diodes at 5 and 10 gigahertz, really high frequency, and very small voltages required to turn them on, and they've got a forward to reverse on-off ratio that's very good, and some of them can take numbers like 5 and 10 volts of reverse bias. So in certain applications, they're very handy. And I'm guessing there's some high-power versions of them, but still a pure Schottky diode as a transmitting-type TR relay circuit I think that's a little bit rare, but maybe you've seen them, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I understand they're in use. I haven't worked with them. I have only seen a certain equipment, like you say, in Hewlett Packard. I noticed. Where I've run into it, yes, you hit the, as they say, the old proverbial nail on the head. They came out with a very good double-balanced mixer. In fact, who designed it? Our good friend, Ulrich, is his real name. I call him Yuli. Rode from Rode and Schwartz Corporation and KA2WEU. And he designed, and I understand, is in production. I believe he owns or has a part interest in a company called Siliconex. And they are using a very advanced, excellent, high 60 dB separation, something in that order, with only about a 25 dB dBm requirement in the local oscillator for complete operation of his double balanced mixer. Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm doing a search right now for Ulrich Rode, and I should know his call letters, DL something or other. Looks like here, DL6UR. Here he is, Ulrich Rode. That's one of his many call letters. He's got American call letters and German call letters and so on. ULRICHRHODE. DL6ULR is one of his sets of call letters. And I think him or one of his relatives is the founder of the Rode and Schwartz company that makes some very nice test equipment. So Rode makes a very good mixer. Another man in the early 70s who was setting the state-of-the-art of doubly balanced mixers was Ferenc Marki, M-A-R-K-I, I think is the spelling of his name, a man in Silicon Valley who I've had a number of conferences with, and boy, can he make very fancy, high-performance, doubly balanced mixers. So these fancy diodes can really do some magic. A diode mixer, by all common sense, because you don't have a plus 12-volt lead on that assembly, because you put no power into it, it's very easy to say, hey, this is passive, and all passive networks must follow certain rules. When you're using a doubly balanced mixer that's made out of four diodes, it is really an active circuit. The amount of local oscillator power you put into the LO port and the biasing that creates of the diodes internally makes the equivalent of a power supply. As such, you know what RF frequency you've put in, you know what local oscillator frequency you put in, the sum and difference of those frequencies comes out as the IF frequency, and so you know exactly what IF frequencies you're going to get out. You can predict them mathematically. Therefore, because it is, in your mind, a passive network, and most passive...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
We have a fix. Most passive networks obey the law of reciprocity. That means whatever happens in the transmit mode, it'll do the exact same thing in the receive mode, which recognized. And so you take all of those output frequencies you get from your doubly balanced mixer on the IF port, and you pour them back in, and you think you're going to get your original frequencies coming back out of the RF port. Not necessarily. It really is an active network. I know that's a little bit off to one side of what Colin has been asking us. So there's a lot to be learned here, as you can tell, Colin. There are diodes and there are diodes. Schottkys, and high-power Schottkys, and pins, and FET transistors, and the kinds of diodes that exist in the world. There's a large number of them for various frequencies, various powers, and so on. And very, very handy devices. So good luck with your project, and come back and let us know what you've chosen and how it works out. So back for a final is KC2 Zebra Papa Mike, K2RIW. Got it, Colin.
I think I'll use MOSFETs for the switching because of the lower losses of them. You know, I'm planning on building a QRP transceiver, and I want it to run very low power. Over.
I think you probably made a good choice. And as I said, as you develop that circuit and you find out how well it's working, please come back and give us a progress report. Sounds like Rich wanted to give us some further questions or comments. N2 Echo Oscar, the former WB2TCC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, that's who we are. I was going to say, Google the name Paul Shush. Forget how he spells it, but when I wrote the article in Ham Radio Magazine, I think it was April, I think it was April 1981, I had used a lot of Paul Shush's information that he wrote previously in Ham Radio Magazine on double balance mixes using hot carrier diodes. I played around with the HP2800 diode in those days, but that's a name you can look up. I don't remember his call letters. I hope he's still around. And the young gentleman designing the radio, good luck to you. I don't know if he's an engineering student, Dick, but my hat's off to him, because you don't find many young people designing RF circuits today. There's a real shortage of that, so I just want to encourage him to go ahead and even if he does not 100% successful the first time, keep going at it. Yeah, Dick, that's who we are.
K2KY, yes.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Ulrich Rode, in his double balance mixer, which is being marketed, I looked it up, by Siliconex Corporation under the number SD5000. They got away from using diode rings. Very interesting how they did that. They have two versions of it. One, they're using transistors. They use two transistors in there. And the dynamic range, IP, is minus 33 dBm with only 15 to 17 dBm of local oscillator drive. And its insertion loss is approximately 6 dB. He says, in comparison to a diode ring mixer, it would require 25 to 27 dB of local oscillator to achieve the same IP3. So he's marketing something. Here it is, a mixer that requires, well, you got to supply it with 9 volts, Dick, but it's, let me tell you, in using it, I've used it, and it's a fantastic little device. Over.
There's about 3 companies, and I can't think of any of their names right now, that are making so-called active mixer assemblies that do an extremely good job. Extremely good job in that they require very little local oscillator power, because you can say there's active gain inside. You apply 9 volts or 12 volts or whatever to the network. It's called active mixer. And they're made up of various kinds of transistors. And some of these things have got differential inputs and common mode inputs, and same thing with the outputs. And some of them are even networks where you can have an in-phase and quadrature mixing function, so that the mixer becomes a vector network assembly. So active, so-called doubly balanced mixers, or let's just call them active mixers, is a field that has made a lot of progress in the last 5 years or so. And the department I've worked in has used quite a few of them, and they're very happy with the results.
Hmm.
I'm seeing the logo in my brand name right now for the data sheet on one of these things, and I can't think of the brand name. But you just start Googling the word active mixer. Guarantee you'll find a number of companies. You'll find a wiki article on it and so on. It's a good thing to learn about, because by way of, let me drop. Due to the fact that a high percentage of the radios we use these days do use the superheterodyne philosophy of the radio design, where the RF input frequency is mixed, usually down but sometimes up, to another fixed frequency called intermediate frequency. There's a whole lot of advantages in doing that. And so the mixing function requires a high performance out of that mixer component. And the active mixers these days have much higher dynamic range, much higher third-order intercept point. That's the one. That's one of the qualities, one of the parameters you use for measuring the quality of a mixer and how strong a signal it can tolerate, how much dynamic range it has. So active mixers are becoming very popular. They're extremely small, very efficient, and high in performance. Other than that, they're good, and they're not super expensive anymore. So good thing to know about. John was the next person on the list. KC2WGB, go right ahead with